Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, wherever and whenever you may be, and welcome to episode 156 of the Fade to Black podcast. I'm Clarice Lockery.
I'm Amon Woman.
And I'm Hannah Flint.
This week, Amon speaks to Challenger screenwriter Justin Kuritzkus as we ace the movie, press play on action movie Boy Kills World, and dream of tomorrow's freedom with Georgia and Sophia Scott's portrait of imprisoned Palestinian political leader Marwan Barghouti. Plus, in our hot take, with, I guess, the X-Men being an inevitability in the MCU, I watched half of the Deadpool and Wolverine trailer.
Only half.
I got distracted by other things. We are going to finally do what no one else can and fan cast the X-Men in the MCU.
Because we did such a good job with Fantastic Four.
Right.
Before that, though, let's check in on the team and see what everyone has been doing. I actually don't know what people have been doing. I saw both of you separately at screenings, but I don't know what you've been up to in the middle.
Caught up in the middle, jumping in the
middle. Hannah, what have you been up to?
We did interview for interviews on Monday. You know what? I'm going to tell you what my exciting thing was this week, because it felt like, I don't know, it was a really just like a nice moment for me as a Bruce Springsteen fan. Amon went to, he'll have the interviews next week for Fall Guy. He spoke to David Leitch and Kelly
McCormick.
And I'm doing a piece for BBC Culture on stunts in Fall Guy. So I got to speak to David, Drew Pearce, the writer, Logan and Ben, two of the stunt guys, and of course, the Ryan Gosling. My favourite thing was, I think I actually had a very good outfit on. I was getting lots of compliments for my outfit, but it was basically like such a dad outfit, because the t-shirt was a Tunnel of Love Bruce Springsteen t-shirt, which my dad got from the like 1988 tour, which I have now. He's gifted it to me. He also gave me this old Paul Smith suit of his, which I got taken in so I could wear. And I was wearing like New Balance. So I just felt like, God, I'm such a dad today. Anyway, Ryan Gosling really responded to my dad look, because he was like, oh my God, I love that album. And I was like, yeah, I do too, Ryan. And it was like, you know, those moments. And then the next day I saw Challengers, and I hear Tunnel of Love in a very important scene. And I'm like, what? I never hear Tunnel of Love. So I've basically been like kind of coasting off that energy this week. And that's about it.
That's nice. Amon, did you have your tastes justified by any celebrities or media this week?
Regrettably, no. but yeah, I did have a fun time at the Fall Guy junket. Yeah. We could have talked for a lot longer, and they wanted to, but those pesky PR people were like, no, that's your time. But it was a fun chat, and we will have it for you next week. And obviously last week, as I mentioned, I did the Q&A with Daisy Ridley and Rachel Lambert for Sometimes I Think About Dying, which was really, really fun. And both of them were on very, very good form, and a good time was had. So yeah, good stuff.
I really liked Daisy's outfit as well that I saw from the photos.
Yeah,
it was like some like play romper suit. It had shapes and
yeah,
it was very interesting. I loved it.
She was very cold, but yes, I've heard another
piece. Yeah. She looked great. Yeah. So
fashion.
I had my media justified by a movie, because I was at the Idea Review, and I don't know why, but for some reason in that movie, they play my favorite scene from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. And I reacted like, you know, like Captain America had just walked on screen.
You did. I was sat next to you for this moment. And I
kind of
test.
Literally. I kind of.
Which scene is it?
Well, Hannah, I don't want to tell you because I don't want to spoil it.
Yeah.
And because you haven't seen The Idea Review yet, so I don't want to spoil that movie for you. But also, I don't know if you've seen the scene in Always Sunny, so I don't want to spoil that scene for you. We'll talk about
it. We'll find out next week.
We'll talk about it next week.
There were a lot of reactions in that movie, and not just from Clarice.
The other bit that I can say that made me absolutely lose it is when he's in the recording booth and he's doing his like original song, and he goes, "Yeah," like a full blown Ariana Grande, "Yeah."
I love these out of context moments.
a good yeah will always set me off. I don't know how I'm going to get through Wicked. It's going to be tough. But that's a future review, because now we're talking about our first film of the week, Challengers.
You think that tennis is about expressing yourself, doing your thing? You don't know what tennis is.
What is it?
Tashi Duncan.
She's in another league.
You were incredible today.
Come on!
To have a fashion line, a foundation. It's gonna turn a whole family into millionaires.
What are you gonna do now?
Unfortunately, my only skill in life is hitting a ball with a racket.
I want you to be my coach.
I want you to be my coach.
How often does this happen? Going after the same girl? Come here.
Which one of us?
This is a game about winning the points that matter.
I don't need to play my games with you.
Come have a cigarette with me, I have to talk to you.
I don't smoke, and I'm not talking to you.
He's not in love with you.
What makes you think I want someone to be in love with me?
Hey, I love you.
I know. You wish you never ever
met her at all. She's a man-eater, make you work hard, make you spend hard, make you want all of her love. She's a man-eater, make you buy cars, make you cut cars, make you fall real hard in love. Oh, that entire album, Nelly Furtado was doing her thing.
I just love that she went like, I'm like a bird, and then says like, she's a promiscuous girl, wherever you are. Like, that's the Timbaland power. Timbaland did also, if you think about it, Timbaland also produced like Justin Timberlake's album with Pharrell.
Yeah.
So he went from like Dirty Pop Pop to Miami River. Mm. Yeah. God, Timbaland was literally the king of the like 90s noise.
Yeah. I don't know if I'm allowed to say this based on what happened last week, but I'm going to say it anyway. The Promiscuous Girl video is pretty great. I'm just going to say that.
Why is that? What's your favourite scene?
I don't know what to say anymore. It's like I'm not allowed to thirst, but it's fine. It's fine.
You can thirst.
You sure?
It's what
Luke. But you're a critic. Done. You're a film critic.
This is a film. This is a music video. And
it's a film. It's a short film. It's music.
No, wait, look. Yeah. We're in the safe Luca Guadagnino space.
This is very true. If not
people
now,
should
then when?
Everyone should give. Luca would approve.
He would. He would. But yeah, Nelly Furtado looked very, very good in that video. There you go. So, Tashi Duncan. We're talking challenges now. Tashi Duncan is a former tennis prodigy turned coach and a force of nature who makes no apologies for her game on and off the court. Married to a champion on a losing streak, Tashi's strategy for her husband's redemption takes a surprising turn when he must face off against the washed-up Patrick, his former best friend and Tashi's former boyfriend. As their past and presents collide and tensions run high, Tashi must ask herself, what will it cost to win? This is directed by Luca Guadagnino, and it stars Zendaya, Josh O'Connor, and Mike Feist, and it's written by Justin Kuritskis, who I had the pleasure of talking to a couple of weeks ago when he and the Challengers people were in town. This is his first like major feature script, and he's aced it, pretty much. It's a really impressive first outing from him. I did ask him about his partner, Celine Song, who was, I think, writing Past Lives around the same time as he was writing this, which is pretty incredible. Past Lives, we discussed on a previous episode of the pod. We already liked it. I have a feeling that it's going to be a similar vibe with this, but enough from me. Here is me talking to Justin Kovitzkis. Welcome to the Play to Back podcast, Justin. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great.
I'm good. So good to meet you. I've seen Challenges. I love Challenges.
Oh, man.
Performers. Congratulations on the movie. I cannot wait to see it again. My first question to you would be, what came first, the tennis or all the stuff off the court?
That's such a good question. The initial impulse to write the movie came from tennis, but pretty immediately I was starting to see it. You know, the first sort of scene came to me as this geometry of these characters on a tennis court. And I immediately started to think, well, what's going on between them beyond the tennis? You know, why are they so invested in what happens in this low-level match, you know, that doesn't matter so much for their careers, but what's going on with them personally? So that stuff started to flood in pretty quickly afterwards.
When you started putting pen to paper, did you have a particular genre in mind that you wanted to tackle? Because this is a mixture of stuff. It's a sports movie. It's a comedy.
Yeah.
There's drama to it. I've heard it described as an erotic thriller. There's so many things. Were you thinking of any one thing, or did it just start to present itself to you a certain way as you started writing?
Yeah. No, I mean, I don't really think about genre so much when I'm writing. And with this movie, I knew that it would be a sports movie and be thought of in that genre to some extent, just because any movie that has sports is a sports movie. But you know, you think about boxing movies, for example. We don't really think of those as sports movies, you know, in the way that we do basketball or football movies. And I think that's because boxing movies on the whole are really good.
Yeah.
You know? And they're about individuals. They're about people who are alone with an opponent.
Yeah.
And I think so that all of a sudden shifts it out of what you might expect from a sports movie. And I really wanted to see what you could do with tennis that would be more in line with what people have already done with boxing and make it a story about, you know, these two people, and then you learn this third person.
Mission accomplished, Justin.
Thank you so much.
I think you've touched on it a little bit, but there's a line in the film early on, tennis is a relationship. How early on in the process of you writing it did you land on that line? Because so much of the movie is in that line.
Yeah.
And feels like it's evolving from that line in a way. Was that quite early on that you landed on that line? It's like, okay, this is the movie right here. This is the spine.
No, actually, it's what's funny about that line is that was something I discovered in pre-production. Like pretty close to when we actually filmed the scene. I rewrote some of that scene to have that line in there. And I remember, I actually still remember showing it for the first time to Zendaya and it clicking with her immediately. And I thought, okay, that's going in the movie.
Good decision.
Yeah.
I love that. Well, to your point, I imagine that you are on set for this, if not for most of it, then all of it. Talk about really adapting certain lines to the actors as you saw what they were doing. And was there anything, obviously there's a certain script that they go into it with, but things change as you film. Was there any particular line or a script that you had that really evolved and changed from what you initially had planned?
Well, you know, when you write the first draft of a movie, and especially with this movie, which I wrote on spec, which means, you know, nobody was attached. I was kind of just writing it for me. And there, you're really, you're not thinking about actors. You're thinking about just the characters, and you're trying to make people see the movie on the page so that you can convince them to make the movie. But then once the movie starts going into production, you're dealing all of a sudden with real people. And that reality merges with the reality of the character that's on the page, and it becomes this really beautiful meeting place, you know. So, of course, the fact that it was Zendaya, Mike, and Josh informed different lines in the script, you know, little things here and there and big things. The funniest story I can think of from set with one of those, I hope she won't mind me saying this. There was a line early in the script where Patrick and Art are supposed to be flirting with Tashi.
Yeah.
And the line I had written was purposefully kind of lame for Patrick to say. It was supposed to be a kind of goofy line.
Yeah.
And we rehearsed it, and it was like, it's too lame. And I agreed with her. And And so I was like, okay, I'll come up with something else. And I was sitting, we had like 5 minutes to do the shot. You know, we were setting up the camera and I was trying to think of this other line. And the whole time I'm doing it, both Zendaya and Luca are looking at me. And Zendaya's going like this and going, come on, cool guy, come up with some cool lines. And she was doing it lovingly. But that was the only time in my life where I thought, Zendaya, would you go away, please, and let me work. But yeah, so that was that. Stuff like that would happen.
I'm happy that you handled the pressure. You got the new line in.
Yeah, you know, it was, believe it or not, that made me feel very supported. So I felt fine. Yeah.
I loved that, It all worked out in the end. So much of this movie is in the gestures and the reactions, and I absolutely love that. What is the balance for you as a writer and as a collaborator with Luca?
Yeah.
And getting that right, when do you realize that for this you might need dialogue, for this that we don't, and the balance of those two things? Because I think it's just spot on.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Well, a lot of it had to be in the script, you know, because again, you're trying to make the reader see the film. And as you said, so much of this film is about the way people are looking at each other, the things that are communicated without language. And so much of the impulse for me to write the film was about the opportunity that a tennis court provides you to tell a story through gestures. So a lot of it was in the script. But then, of course, when Luca and I started talking about the script, and especially once he started shot listing with his team, there was a lot of calibration and refinement of all of that stuff that was a real joyful part of the process, because I got to really see him work on a molecular level with the visual language of film, which was like going to film school, honestly, getting to watch him do that.
I love that. Yeah. The allegiances of the audience changes, I think, as the film progresses, as we learn more about the character's history and what they do in the present as well. For you, as you're writing it, do you feel your allegiance change? And what was the first experience for you watching this film like, written it? I mean, you know all the beats that are coming, but do you still get swept up in everything?
My allegiances as I was writing it definitely switched a lot, because, you know, I knew what the structure of the movie was. I knew who the characters were, and I knew some of the things that were going to happen. But as you're writing, things surprise you. Mm-hmm. And at a certain point, you'll sort of realize that the characters are pushing the story in a direction that you didn't anticipate. Yeah. And so I was just as surprised as anybody watching it when I was writing it, which was, that's when writing's fun,
right. You
know. When I'm watching it now, honestly, I just think about the work that the actors are doing and the work that Luca did. I really just see it as like appreciation of how good my friends are at their jobs when I watch it now.
Yeah, I concur. They're pretty good at their jobs.
Yeah.
Final question for you. I actually had the honor of doing a Q&A with someone you may have heard of, Celine Song,
year
for Past Lives. I'm just wondering, were you guys writing your respective movies at the same time, and what notes were you exchanging with each other?
Oh, man. Well, Celine wrote Past Lives before I wrote Challengers. You know, we were each other's first readers and harshest critics, and we really try to support each other in that way.
I love that. Power couple. Yeah. Amazing. Justin, thank you so much for your time. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Again, it's fantastic.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Really good to meet you, man.
Good to meet you, too.
So I think Luca Guadagnino, he has a very well-won reputation as a director of sensual cinema. You think about Call Me By Your Name, you think about A Bigger Splash, and I definitely feel like those talents came to the fore in this movie as well. What did you make of the sensualness, the sexiness of this movie? Clarice, let's start with you.
Luca, like, just an incredible, I think, capturer of desire. And I think what I really like about his movies is that he is very invested in kind of going to slightly uncomfortable places and trying to talk about the desire that maybe No, because it's especially taboo. I mean, obviously Bones and All was about cannibals. So it's a bit taboo. But I think it's more about, you know, the kind of desire that makes you feel awful, but you can't really resist it and you just have to. And that's sort of what Challengers is to me, is the nature of the desire in this movie is so, it's so kind of like complicated, and who's desiring who for what reason, and what is pure desire in Challengers, and what is maybe like because it's also intermixed with this idea of competitiveness and sport and wanting to be the best and wanting to overpower your opponent. And when you throw sex into that, it becomes very tangled, right? And so you spend the whole movie, I think, trying to figure out, right, who out of these three people like actually loves the other person that they say that they love, and who maybe just wants control over the situation or to be more in power than them. And I have my answer, but I you know, I think it's up for interpretation. That's what's fun about Challengers.
It's interesting. I've heard from people that in earlier versions of this film, there was more explicit sex, shall we say, and that doesn't make it into the final film. And I don't think it needs it personally, because that desire you're mentioning, that seduction, all of that comes through. And yeah, I don't feel like it needed to go that sort of extra mile to really displaying that sort of thing more explicitly. Would you agree with that, Hannah?
I don't know. If I'd seen the version with a lot more sex, I don't think I'd mind it. I would have quite enjoyed seeing Josh O'Connor being fucked by a tennis racket. Is that what they cut?
No, there was a scene.
Wait, is this from a festival version, and then this one's come out? They've cut out.
No, it would not. It would have been earlier.
Yeah. But yeah,
I think the thing about it is more that, and I think this is why I think it's actually a really great sports film.
Yeah.
As well as a kind of like quite like sort of slightly maniacal kind of romance psychological thriller in a way, is that it's the love of tennis supersedes all, and the love of this sport. And I guess that's the real kind of like ecstasy for them. That's the orgasm. Like, you know, I think what was interesting for me was like, there is a, I guess maybe I maybe watched you first, but I could just see how this is going to end, like in this moment, and what they're striving for. And I guess what I really appreciate is that, there's a spider. It kind of really gets to the kind of like that passion, this passion for this game, for this feeling, and they're trying to chase that feeling. It's like this kind of addictive quality. And I guess like some of them kind of lose it a little bit. Some of them, you know, kind of the psychology of it as well, about who is good enough, because about the winning and stuff, it can be, you know, people getting in their own way. You know, there's, you know, I love the fact that Tashi is like, I'm having to live my tennis dreams through these guys because I got injured, so I'm fucked. Or like the way that Mike Feist's character is kind of like, he wants it, but also he's got this really weird, like, sort of inferiority complex that kind of never feels like he can really push it that far, but actually he probably can. And I guess I think with, you know, the way that desire comes across, I think there's a very interesting, like, you can see where Luca Guadagnino's, like, sensibilities come from. It feels far more European film than it does Hollywood. You know, the kind of focus up, the close-ups, the kind of sweat dripping, you know. I mean, look, these tennis balls, like, even, like, there's a shift, like, just the way he, like, one point where Josh O'Connor, like, shifts his cock, and it's just, like, it might be the most erotic, like, some of the most erotic things you've ever seen. And so, yeah, so maybe you don't need it. Maybe it doesn't need to be explicitly need it, but, hey, look, I'm not going to say no to it.
I think this is the most I've seen anyone sweat on screen since Dwayne Johnson in Fast Five. There's so much sweat in this movie. Good grief.
Can I say something about the, because I actually love, I think it really works for this movie to not have, like, I don't know, full penetration. Because there's that line where Tashi's talking about that tennis is a relationship. Mm-hmm. And it's the idea when you get a really good volley going between two people, you fall in love. And I like that the movie's, that's what the movie is. The movie itself is a tennis match, and I think you need to withhold the like orgasm of it until the very, very, I would say the final shot, like that's it, because you sort of, to me, I knew what was going to happen after that movie ends. And I feel like you need to have, this sort of like, you need to be teased by the movie.
It's cinematic really edging, basically.
Yeah. And you spend the whole movie just being like, gosh, what the fuck? And then they go on the tennis court and they're just smacking them. And that's sex. But then they go into their private lives and they're arguing. And that's the tennis match as well. It's like everything's just bled together into this one gigantic like back and forth folly that you're just waiting for like someone to win the point, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that ending. Not going to go into specifics, but it might be for me the most electrifying ending to a movie since Whiplash. I'm not saying it's better. I'm not saying it's a better movie ending than Whiplash, because that's goated for life for me. But I've seen it twice now, and that ending is absolutely phenomenal. So much is said, barely a word is uttered. Cinema, so great. I want to talk more about the three central characters, in particular Tashi, because with that character in particular, I love the messiness of her. Hannah, you touched on it earlier in terms of she has her career basically taken from her, and a lot of what she does in this is about getting control of the situation. But yeah, like, it could easily, I've had conversations with people who are not as high on this film, and they say that that character in particular comes across as a bit of a villain, a bit of a bitch, and
they're all villains. They're all unlikable people. That's what I love about it. They're just awful. They're awful people, all of them, because that's the kind of what I'm saying about like tennis means more. It will always usurp everything. I think her is, she's harsh, she's blunt, she can be vicious. I like that. I think she's uncompromising. I think, you know, the fact that she is, I think what I really enjoy about also the way the script is written is there are so many like little lines, throwaway lines that give you kind of backstory that you don't need to, so it doesn't have to go in it. It's so un-exposition heavy, really, in a way, because like, of course, you've got the backstory and stuff like that, but it really is like, you know, the fact that she's a black woman is so obvious, like in this context of these two white boys from privilege, and like she's like the character who, you know, this is everything to her because she gets like the scholarship and she needs all these things, and it's so much sense. So for her to lose this, like in the way that she did in the circumstances, you feel that frustration. You might not like Tashi, but you can appreciate, you can respect her for like actually like doing something and building herself up. I think she's got edges and she hasn't softened herself for the people around her. And I really appreciate it. It's interesting. I think she is striving to control everything, but life isn't, you can't control life. And I think that's what's an interesting thing, that tension there of her trying to, you know, the stakes about, you know, keep going back and forth in time, and then certain later bits, how she wants to kind of, her and her husband, the tension within that relationship, and then how kind of Josh O'Connor's character, what's his name again? Philip.
Patrick.
Swike. Patrick. That's it, Patrick Swike. Like how he comes in, and it's just, she's just trying to have a control over everything to have some sort of stability. Maybe it comes out another way. So I actually found her, I don't have to like her to love her character.
Yeah, I don't think of any of them as the villain. I think they're just people. And people are complicated and kind of awful to each other quite often. I think what I like about the movie is that they all have their moments. Even Art, which is the Mike Feist character, like you kind of think he's the sweet little husband, but then there's shit that he does that you're like, I see you. So yeah, I like that the movie really gives you the opportunity to root who you like, for who you want to root for, but you're going to have to make compromises to root for that person. And that's what's sort of enjoyable about it. And I think Zendaya's performance, she's really good at picking roles that exploit her like star power very well. Like we were having this whole conversation about like the death of the star, and I feel like Zendaya, she's not there yet, but I think she knows what she's doing, and she's getting to that point of like picking these roles where it's like that Zendaya on screen, and there's those slow motion things with her hair like bobbing while she's like striding down the alleyway and like her and the tennis court watching the match, and there's like that Strangers on a Train homage shot where all the heads are like going back and forth, but Zendaya is in the center of the frame. It's all about Zendaya.
Not moving.
And she just looks incredible. She has like incredible posture and poise, and like she just carries herself like a movie star in all of her roles. And I feel like, I don't know, I feel like if we want to have the conversation about could the movie star come back, I would start with her, because she has the potential for it.
Yeah, it's really interesting, isn't it? Because you can look at like the choices that she's made over the last, like, I know people hated, like, some people hated Malcolm Marie. I fucking loved it. And this feels like a kind of, like, that sort of vein of, like, the character that she's playing. These kind of, you know, I like it when people are, I like it when actors are playing characters that you don't, are not immediately likable. And I think that's the star energy. Because if you can, for me, I mean, yeah, the fact that she exudes this kind of very, yeah, I guess it's quite old Hollywood glow as well, because she's like obviously model-esque, is statuesque, you know. Made me realize that Josh O'Connor is quite tall, because she's wearing heels on one bit and she's a tall gown. He's still tall. I was like, oh, Josh O'Connor, how tall are you, please? But yeah. I also like the fact that Josh O'Connor, who I've seen in so many things playing a really nice guy, just like nice guy. And this, he was like, nope, I'm your fuckboy. He's so great in this. He's so great. And I love him with like an, like with a, like what do you call that sort of beard? Like a,
Just kind of stubbly. It's sort of stubble, a little bit of stubble.
Yeah. I love that everything was quite tight on him. When he's playing tennis, it's like, I'm the rock star. I don't give a
shit. And I like that. Like when I watched it for the first time at the kind of, in the first half of the movie, I was like, oh, they seem like they should be playing each other's roles. Because, like, Mike Weiss, I guess because I know him mostly from West Side Story, he plays the hothead very well. But I feel like them playing slightly against type works really, really well, because it adds some nuance to those characters, because Patrick is a fuckboy, but he can come across really sweet sometimes because it's Josh O'Connor, and he has, like, I feel like he has a bit of, like, an innate sweetness to him. And Mike Feist, like, I don't know, there's something like, he's forever a newsie in my head. So he's bringing the newsie energy to the also, to the simp husband, which kind of, you know, picks it up a bit. I like it.
Yeah, he feels like he's like a cuck. It's big cuck energy.
Yeah.
I like that you brought up Malcolm and Marie, because I feel like in a lot of the writing I've seen on this film, people have been very quick to say this is like Zendaya's first adult role. I'm like, Malcolm and Marie wasn't that long ago, and that felt pretty adult to me, but because I think people don't like that movie, they just want to dismiss it and forget about it entirely. But yeah, I too enjoyed that movie.
Yeah, it's funny, my friend Justin was like, I was telling him, she goes, yeah, but she's always like a teen in my head. I was like, she's 27 years old. And she's like technically playing like 30-something.
Yeah.
If you think, because it goes back and forth in time, like 13 years, isn't it? That's the biggest gap. So 18 to 32, I guess.
Before we go, I need to mention the incredible score by Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross, which is just so, so good. It's really utilized within various scenes so well, at times getting so quiet that it almost falls out of the scene and then ratcheting back up again at a crucial moment within the scene. I think that was just really, really well done. Obviously, very techno inspired. Got a lot of sort of house club vibes, but it works really, really well within the film. And I'm really excited to listen to it on its lonesome as well. Fantastic work.
What I really liked about it is that I really felt that it was actually it was like heart palpitations. I think any time that you saw a character where they're kind of like emotions, like they were about to get angry or they're about to feel something, something feels up, something like there's a bit where She's, I think it must have been like one of the flashback scenes, but Zendaya's like sat at a table, Atlanta. And then she sees Josh O'Connor. She sees Patrick come by, and then suddenly it goes. And it's like every time that happened, or like they're in a sauna, and then you can see someone getting angry, and then the score comes in. So for me, I loved how much it seemed to reflect that kind of like heart racing, like suddenly you're feeling a burst of emotion that came out. And yeah, I don't think I've ever seen like a score really have that sort of emotive, I guess, like signal, like start off and on, like, you know, the kind of, you said about like going down a bit and then coming up again. It really felt
elastic.
Yeah, I thought it felt that really good. I think we should also, sorry, we should also talk about the cinematography, because I think it's actually one of the best shots, tennis matches I've probably, you know, I think they did some really creative stuff in that. Because I think about like Love and Basketball, and how there's one of my favorite scenes is when Monica is playing a game and you're actually in the perspective of her. So you're looking through her eyes as she's on the court, and then you're hearing her kind of internal monologue. And it really gets into that psychology of it. And then you don't really hear that in this, but you do have the perspective of each player as they're hitting. You have the perspective of the tennis ball. You have this undershot perspective of like the kind of, it's like it must be shot on like a see-through glass with like the lines on it. You get so intensely into it. It was amazing. I thought that was just like one of the most palpable, like technical achievements when it comes to like camera work where I've seen with like a sports match. So maybe the best shot. There's not that many tennis films, but
no.
Best shot tennis film.
The cinematographer is Sayombu Mukdipram. I also want to say I really enjoyed the color grading. I like that it was kind of oversaturated. And
yeah,
because everybody who's not the tennis players in this movie acts kind of weird. Like they're very, I would say, Lynchian, if that makes sense. They kind of act like they're all in Twin Peaks, like very Americana, like a little too sweet. I don't know. There's something interesting about everyone else in this movie.
I really like the umpire.
Yeah, this is just really interesting. And like the woman at the motel.
Yeah.
It's just interesting characters of this.
Amazing. Well, Challengers is in cinemas right now. It's time for our screen, stream, or skip recommendations on Luca Guadagnino's latest film, Hannah Flint.
Screen.
Clarice Lockway.
Screen. Just Luca forever.
And it is a screen for me. This is my film of the week. It might even be my film of the year so far. I freaking love it! Cannot wait to see it again. All right, from Challenger 1 and Challenger 2 to Player 1 and Player 2, it's time for Boy Kills World.
Let's do this. This was never a great city, but it was ours.
Are you with me? Always.
Until Hilda Vanderkoy took it from us. This is how she keeps control. They call it the Calling.
They're all gonna watch and cheer as you die.
That's me, facing televised execution by breakfast cereal mascots. Not my happiest day. But let me take you back to an even worse one. The day the Vanderkoys killed my family and left me deaf and mute. So, I made a three-step plan. Step one, give myself an inner voice. I took the last one I remembered from this video game. Player one wins! Step two, get stronger. A lot stronger. And step three, join a team.
Welcome to the Resistance!
Take me on a trip, I'd like to go someday. Take me to New York, I'd love to see LA. I really want to come kick it with you. You'll be my murderous boy, my murderous boy.
Very good.
Boy, who's deaf and mute, has a vivid imagination and is driven by his inner voice, one which he co-opted from his favourite childhood video game. He vows revenge after his family is murdered by Hilda Vanderkoy, the deranged matriarch of a corrupt post-apocalyptic dynasty that left the boy orphaned, deafened and voiceless. Boy trains with a mysterious shaman to become an instrument of death and set loose on the eve of that annual culling of dissidents. Wow, okay. Intense. Directed by Moritz Moore, written by Tyler Burton Smith and Arend Remmers. It stars Bill Skarsgård, H. John Benjamin, Jessica Roth, Michelle Dockery, Famke Janssen, Charlton Copley, and Yayan Ruhian. I love Yayan Ruhian. He's from the Raid, mm-hmm. among other things, but The Raid mm-hmm. is the one. Okay, so I haven't seen this. A lot of people were like tweeting stuff about this, like going mad about it. Is it kind of like an intense, like, just like battle of murder, blood, gore all the way through? Clarice, like, what was your impressions going in, and I guess the impression coming out?
Yeah, I mean, I saw a lot, kind of an interesting action movie with a lot of handheld choreography and like fun camera work is the impression I got. And I will say the stunt choreography is good in this. That's pretty much where I can't say anything else that I enjoyed about this movie. I saw on Letterboxd a lot of people were saying, we shouldn't have let Deadpool exist. And so I'm interested in the fact I really did not enjoy this movie at all as someone who is a little bit of a Deadpool apologist. Like, I sort of quite like those movies and I sort of quite like that character. Because I think the thing with Deadpool, I will say, be a Deadpool defender, is that those movies do have a bit of like a nice balance between the sarcasm and also the sincerity, and it's quite sweet in places. And there is like a weird inverted wholesomeness to Deadpool that I think I respond to that is very much absent from this movie. That's just like the vibe is I saw Kingsman once and I really liked that and I wanted to do it, but I didn't understand how to replicate that tone. So it's very like lots of extreme violence. H. John Benjamin narration has lots of jokes in it. I don't think I could remember any. I'm really sorry. and then there's this like whole Hunger Games dystopian thing, which I did not understand, but it's just like nasty and unpleasant without having any, I don't know, like sense of emotional sincerity or attachment to anything. Like, you do not root for these characters because I don't understand what any of their deals are, I guess. Does that make sense, Amon? I also don't know where this movie is set because it seems like it's Indonesia, but it's not, because all the characters who have lines, apart from the shaman, who also actually doesn't have that much dialogue, are white. So I have questions about where this is meant to be.
I'm nodding my head to a lot of what you're saying, Khaleesi. You're hitting it right on the head. I do want to mention the action and fight design. The person who's in charge of all that is David Zatarsky, and he does a really, really great job. There's a couple of scenes that genuinely had me thinking, I don't think I've seen that before. There's one scene where a cheese grater is used as a weapon and created
Evil Dead Rise.
Okay, I haven't seen that movie.
Didn't he have one in Monkey Man as well? I feel like the cheese grater thing has happened a lot recently.
Has it?
I feel like we can no longer claim the cheese grater as original.
Okay. Well, I'll take it back. Maybe I won't. I don't know. But I thought that was clever regardless. And there's a couple of other fight scenes where I was like, okay, the camera's being dynamic. Sometimes the moves aren't as well hidden as they could be, but action-wise, I thought it was impressive. But the lack of world-building in this film was really, really a problem. And it gets more and more of a problem the longer we go in. Khaleesi is absolutely right in terms of beyond the violence and beyond that initial, you know, my family was killed, I'm going to go after the people who did it. We don't really get to know much about the characters. They try and be quirky with H. John Benjamin doing that voice. And for a while, it kind of works.
So sorry, can you just explain to me a little bit about he's doing a voiceover?
Yeah, so boy, played by Bill Skarsgård, he's a deaf mute. What happens in that initial trauma that he goes through in terms of his family getting killed, that renders him a deaf mute. So we get voiceover from H. John Benjamin, which is Boyd's
internal monologue.
And for a while that works, then it gets a little bit grating. So that was mixed. But I think for me, the world building was a massive problem. And then just in terms of who I'm rooting for, there are things which happen in the final act in terms of major reveals that really muddy those waters for me in a big way. And I feel like what the movie is trying to do there is have that reveal that makes you root more for certain people. But that reveal made me want to root for nobody. And part of the reason why it's so muddy and messy is because of the lack of world building that the film has done in the preceding hour and a half of the film. By the way, this film is overlong as well. I should say that. So yeah, I wanted to like it more than I did. I came away just thinking that the action is good, but what else has really served me in this film? And the answer to that question was very lacking, unfortunately.
Yeah, I think we can say the final fight is between three characters who were all established as good guys. So I was like, who are we rooting for?
Exactly.
You said all three of these characters are on the right side of this supposed dystopia. What?
There's so many questions I had, and there's so many things that would have been really, really interesting to get into. Boy and his relationship with the shaman played by Yayan Ruhian. There's a lot of really interesting stuff to get into. How did their relationship develop? Now that, you know, he knows what he learns what he learns in the final act, how does that change their relationship? There's so many unanswered questions. And Hannah, I thought of you and what you thought of the creator in terms of the world building watching this film. And just, I think you'd lose your mind watching this film because of the lack of world building. There's so many questions that the film has no interest in answering. And it becomes a real problem in that final act for me.
Well, then I guess round up, it sounds like there's a lot of kooky characters, thing. Are there any characters that stood out?
It's a mixed bag. Like, Charlto Copley is essentially playing the exact same type of character he's playing in Monkey Man. It sounds like there's this wide-eyed, you know, I'm going to do my thing on the mic type thing. And for a while, that's entertaining. But again, like, we've seen it before. They try and do this really weird thing in one of the early fights with a guy who keeps on regenerating after Boy sort of puts him down, like, you know, repairs his broken bones and whatnot. That sort of came out of nowhere. And again, has no basis for what does that mean for this world in the wider sense? Like, can other people do that? We don't really
know. I don't think he can regenerate. The scene was just he was huffing drugs, so he couldn't feel the pain. His jaw was still broken. Because that's why H. John Benjamin, and there's meant to be a joke of like, oh, this guy's just crazy. There's a lot of the narrations like that.
Yeah.
Player two has entered the game.
Yeah.
Oh, no. Game over? No, actually, this guy's just crazy. That's the movie. I'm acting out the movie for you now.
Clarice, did you voice this character?
I am actually H. John Benjamin.
Are you Archer and Bob Belcher?
The funny thing is that the H. John Benjamin role I was thinking about during this movie was not Archer or Bob's Burgers. It was when he voiced the can in Wet Hot
in
America.
Well, yeah, that's, I love that.
What the narration sounds like, the can from that movie.
Okay, let's wrap it up then. So this is out in theatres. Is it a screen, stream, or skip?
Lovely saying, in theatres. Okay, American.
In the cinemas. At your local multiplex. Down the pictures.
I think if you're on, you know, an action hound, then maybe you'll walk away with this having a little bit more fun than I did, but I'm going to say skip.
I also skip. Did not enjoy this at all. I don't know what to recommend instead.
The Raid.
Well, you're still kind of doing The Raid. Watch The Raid. Or like,
I'm excited to talk about stunts next week, though, because what you were saying there about, like, because I think for me, stunts should be in service to the story. Character. It should be basically like, for me, a good action film or film with action should work like a musical number in a musical. Like, you know what I mean? It should help the plot move forward, be learn something about character, get to A to B, but like in an interesting way, you know? And I think when we talk about Fall Guy next week, we can kind of get into like the, what works and what doesn't.
Yeah. Or Old Boy, that's the ultimate stunt lending to story character. That whole hallway scene is one of my favorite stunt pieces ever.
It's so interesting, that hallway scene, because I feel like so many other things, basically, it's done hallway scenes because of that film since then.
There's a hallway scene in Boy Kills World where I was like, Old Boy.
Yeah. Okay, so from, I guess like from one dystopia to another, if we think about it, here is Tomorrow's Freedom.
Хүнгийн махгүй хүмүүс хүм мангасад нөгөө
Marwan was a legitimate leader. He became that symbol of the broader Palestinian resistance.
And I think the Palestinians, with their hearts, with their will, can defeat this Israeli occupation in the future.
If you dare take on the responsibilities and positions of leader, you are taking a tremendous risk.
Here in this street, it was the first time my father's car was hit when they tried to assassinate him.
هذا عدوان إجرامي جديد على شعبنا وعلى مضطراتنا.
Marwan apparently said, "These are the rules of the games. I'll change my state."
Israel pushed him and the entire Palestinian people, and the reality is irreversible.
Israel succeeded to arrest my body, but not my soul.
He is a terrorist and he is murderer.
Everybody in this world knows that Marwan Barghouti is fighting for peace.
I miss him.
We've been here before. Don't fear me.
My father sent me a letter. He said that he's thinking of a huge hunger strike.
From his cell between four walls, a man who has nothing, absolutely nothing, he restored hope in people's hearts.
I think that there is a fair chance that once there are elections, that he will be elected as the president.
Made over the course of 5 years, Tomorrow's Freedom gains intimate access to the family of imprisoned Palestinian political leader Marwan Barghouti. Combining unfolding events on the ground, in-depth interviews, and an archive spanning over 30 years, we see Marwan's evolution from activist to learned politician, uniting people and bringing hope to a flat-lined peace process. If given a chance, could Barghouti pave the way for an inclusive, democratic, and peaceful future? Directed and produced by Georgia Scott and Sophia Scott, co-produced by Saswan Asfari, and executive produced by Tony Tabaksnake, Brian Eno, and Hussein Kurimboy. I think, Hannah, I want to ask you first about, I think what was so striking about this documentary to me is, I would say, watch it if you want to shut down a lot of, if people are coming at you trying to argue things about Palestine and maybe you feel ill-equipped information-wise, I would say watch this documentary and you can shut down a lot of bullshit arguments that pro-Israel people will come at you with. I mean, Hannah, would you agree with that?
Yes. I think the difficulty is, like, you know, even this film, it really struggled. There is a real issue of stories about Palestine, stories about the actual reality of what it's like to live there, really struggled to get out. And I remember seeing this at London Palestine Film Festival in November and the director saying, like, they struggle to get this into like film festivals or get like, you know, broadcasters. When Michael Winterbottom said when he did 11 Days in May, you know, there was these accusations that by the co-director, Palestinian co-director, that he was like Hamas, you know, because that's one thing that they throw around at everyone. And so that one struggled to get like a broadcast distribution as well. So this is exactly the sort of film that the Israeli propaganda media just don't, like factory just does not want you to see. And I think what's really interesting is, you know, anyone, what I think, you know, there is this narrative about, I guess, Palestinian leaders, Palestinian like kind of activists and like, I guess, political figures. And I love how much about this narrative that they're all terrorists, like it's just a terrorist organization. I think the way that they framed this as this, he is basically Palestine's Nelson Mandela. Nelson Mandela was on the terrorist watch list in America until 2008. You know, I saw this revisited this like video recently of like Margaret Thatcher celebrating Nelson Mandela Day. And it's like, remember, it's 5 years since his death. And like, the journalist was like, hold on a second, what did you do at the time? Weren't you all calling him a terrorist? And I think it's just this really amazing context about this figure. You know, what happens when you are basically raised under the boot of an oppressive power? And the fact that, you know, you're zooming in on this one guy, but he really represents every single kind of like political prisoner or like hostage, to be honest. They're being kept hostage. Loads of these Palestinian people in these Israeli jails, which go against, and I think what I love about this film as well, they have so many legal like experts. They have like, you know, Gideon Levy, who's like a reporter. They've got all these people who are like, hey, what Israel is doing is illegal. And it just, yeah, it's just quite, it's got all the receipts. It's got all the facts. It's got all the backup. And so, yeah, anyone who really wants to understand what it's like to try and exist or try and have some sort of like political autonomy in Palestine or why the situation has got to where it is now. It's a really good documentary to understand and cut through all the kind of, I guess, propaganda that's been out there.
Yeah. And I think to see like how Israel treated, you know, a political leader who was very pro-peace, wanting to negotiate, that's what keeps coming up, is that he actually wanted to be in the room with Israeli leaders and negotiate a peace process. And like, you know, look at how they treat it. And I think this whole idea we have at the moment is happening. I remember watching all the American campus protests, which I think as like an American is insane to me. Like, yeah, the idea of like the people keep saying again and again, like, oh, like all the Palestinians are Hamas. They don't want peace. They don't want da da da. And you just need to show them this and go, well, actually, he was the most popular. He's, you know, the most popular politician. I think that's fair to say, right? They say in the documentary, I don't know if that's verifiable.
Yeah.
But yeah, Maron Bagui, he's kind of, he is the Nelson Mandela. He's the most popular guy in Palestine. And that's what they did to him. So like,
and they don't want him out. And it because really interesting how they frame it up. They don't want him out because they think he could actually like lead Palestine. They want the narrative. They want to keep. It's just, it's very, I learned a lot of things. Like, I guess I've kind of, I think it's a really good thing of learning or just like how the idea, the label of terrorist is bandied about. And actually, well, one of the things that I was really interesting in this film was that they said, I think it was terrorist is actually a word invented by oppressive powers to talk about anyone who resists. And I think that's interesting context to kind of like put into it about, you know, terrorism, I think, is an action. And like, I think it's something that's wielded. Terrorism is wielded by people. So I'm not going to deny that like Hamas has done terrorist things, but so is Israel. So is the UK. So is the US. Like all these places to hold on to power, they do, you know, like, is it not terrorism to murder 34,000 people? Is that not a terrorist action? I mean, that's mass murder. That's genocide. So, like, it's just this really interesting context in the film that I really like. And I love the fact it comes in it from the very, like, the family angle to understand what this does to the person who's, you know, because you don't actually get to speak to Marwin. So they have to, so coming in for the perspective of his wife, who's like a lawyer, and then the kind of kids, and then you realize everyone's got a new story about how someone killed someone, like from the IDF murdered something, like Marwin's dog got murdered by an IDF soldier. It's like, that's the kind of like, hey, look, if white Westerners are going to pull a thing at anything, maybe we'll like sympathize to that. If they can't sympathize with like brown kids being murdered, they can sympathize with a dog being shot.
Well, Aman, I want to kind of talk a little bit about the construction of the documentary. Because I think, you know, you're talking about the receipts. It's interesting as well, the variety of voices. I mean, having Jimmy Carter, and then you think, God, well, what does Joe Biden think of Jimmy Carter? Like, is he radical? To anyways. But I think what I really liked was the combination of having these, I guess you would call them expert voices from lots of different organizations. And then also to have this really tight focus on the family, on the wife and his sons who, you know, have been spending this entire time advocating for him and trying to get his release. Amon, what did you think of just, that balance?
Yeah, I think it was really, really well done. You know, I think you both touched on it, the intimate perspective that you get with a film like this from the family is really, really important. And Fadwa, especially his wife, was really, really moving to me at various points in the story. The passion with which she's telling her husband's story, trying to get him out, the personal cost of this entire situation for her and that family really, really comes through. In addition to all the family stuff, you've got the excerpts from the book, A Thousand Days of Solitude, which they go to a couple of times. And I think both times that they do that, it's really, really powerful, the excerpts which they choose to pick out. And then the interviews from the diverse amount of people that you mentioned. It's really, really well put together. At times, it did become a little bit repetitive for me, but not enough to sort of take away from the overall point the film was making, which is very, very powerful. And as I say, very, very moving, especially when it came to Fadwa for me.
Yeah, I mean, Hannah, did you want to add anything just about the range of work? Because they have, like, Israeli officials in it as well. I don't know how that was organized. It seemed quite, like, I mean, it's over the course of 5 years, but it seemed like there was a lot of negotiating to put this together.
Yeah, and I think this is the classic thing where it comes to these documentaries, or even Palestinian, I guess, like, fairness, is that they have to, like, to do a documentary like this, you have to go over the line. You need Israeli voices. You need Jewish voices. You need these people to speak on the behalf of Palestinians because no one believes Palestinians. Like, literally, Palestinians could tell you exactly the same thing, but people won't believe it. But if an Israeli person says, actually, this is wrong, that's why I really respect, like, you know, I think Gideon, as I mentioned, Gideon Levy, he writes for the Jewish Israeli newspaper Haaretz. He's like a columnist there, and he's been one to continuously call the kind of Israeli government into question. I think there was a guy they also have from, like, the UN who was the kind of one who basically said, yeah, like, investigated some of the kind of looked into his court proceedings and said, yeah, this is an unfair fair trial. Mm. This does not. And also the fact that it's illegal to transport out Palestinian people from an occupied territory. You can't do that, but that's what they do every single day. And no one does anything about it. So it's kind of, you're reliant on actual voices outside of that to speak up and say, this is, no, what they're saying is wrong. So this is why it's so important. Like, I really was really glad we could do this film this week, because it just feels like such a vital, and also just understanding again, like, it's this kind of humanizing, understanding, like, these, you know, giving voice to the kind of voiceless. It's kind of wild that we don't, you know, I'd never heard of Marwan Barghouti before this, and now, you know, I can't stop thinking about him, like, when I think about all of this going on. And so yeah, I do think it was, you know, again, it had the receipts, it backed itself up, and I just think, you know, there will still be some people who try and say, oh, there's, you know, there's two sides. It's like, yeah, but there's also the one that's got more facts than the other one. Mm-hmm. But there you go.
Aman, before we wrap, I think we should also mention the music quickly before we wrap up, because it's Brian Eno and also Massive Attack that contributed music to it. I don't know anything about them, Aman. Can you add? I'm so sorry. My limit of knowledge ends there. I know that they exist.
Now, all I'll say about the music is that it's quite plaintive, but unobtrusive. And I think that's the best thing, especially on a documentary which has a lot on its mind like this does. You want to use it gently to accentuate various scenes, but you don't want it to become a real focal point like it was in, say, Challengers. And I think that was, I think that was played just right in this film. So, yeah, that's what it's called.
And he's also, just to say, Mark Brian Erno has always been like a Palestinian activist. So it was very fitting that he scored this.
Yeah. And also, I guess, executive produced. Nice to add his name to it as well. So let's do our screen, stream, or skip on Tomorrow's Freedom. Amon.
Screen.
Hannah.
Screen.
And I would also say screen. You know, obviously Challengers is so much fun and, you know, go see it. But I would say make time for this if you can.
See Challengers and then watch the film challenging the Israeli narrative.
That should be on the posters. Well, we have one more thing to do before we go today. And that is our...
Finally it fits.
I may not have seen that show, but I do know the music. So I feel like I might be taking somewhat of a backseat on this hot take this week. But you know, with the X, when are the X-Men coming?
One before a couple of years.
I guess they're going to do Fantastic Four because they're related, right?
Not really.
No.
No, it's just because Fox owned them. Fox owns Fantastic Four and Fox owned X-Men. And therefore, and can I just, I know we're going to do Fantastic, but like, Clarice, something you said earlier about Deadpool apologists, it's the time of you saying that because I have to spend this week actually defending Deadpool. And you know how much I'm anti Deadpool versus Wolverine for like, just because of my, it's not that I'm anti that, it's more, I'm not anti Deadpool, I'm just anti coming, you know, Hugh Jackman coming back in this way. I think I'll be over it. Hopefully it'll be a good film and be great. But my point, it was because I was talking to someone, and I won't name them because I don't want them to like, think I'm still sharing their hot take opinions without permission. But they were saying, I'm really annoyed with Deadpool because I think it's basically like the Deadpoolification of movies and what you were kind of touching on that thing about like, oh, everything's, there's nothing sincere anymore. Everything's like that. And I was like, hold the fucking phone. Because that's not true. Sorry, I really want to get to see what you get this out because it's just been like annoying me. Because I guess we were talking, it fits in with the X-Men stuff and like, I guess it kind of gets into casting because I really hope, I will say this about the Fox stuff, and obviously Deadpool was part of Fox, but kind of something different. But there was a sincerity in the X-Men and the Fantastic Four films where it took them seriously. It didn't make fun of like the what they do, their costumes or whatever, their names and stuff like that.
What would you prefer?
It wasn't embarrassed about
spandex.
Yeah, it's just like I don't know. I just think it's kind of, it seemed like sort of like taking the mick out of the source material when I feel like Fox didn't really do that as much. But then Deadpool, why? And it annoys me because when they said this, I was like, hold on a second. Deadpool, that was his whole thing. His whole thing was that he broke the fourth wall. He was kind of wacky. He's like mentally unwell. And he goes on like in the comic books, he's this guy who takes the piss out of everything. That is canon. That is literally Deadpool the way he is. So if the MCU have like done this thing where they don't take it serious, don't blame Deadpool. Deadpool came out after a lot of those films came out and started doing that sort of like thing. So I feel like a bit, I'm quite defensive of like, Deadpool is doing exactly what Deadpool should be doing because that fits, that links back to the source material and the character who just makes everything a joke, pretty much. Yeah, every time anyone, it's like, he's annoying. And that's why people get annoying.
This is the thing with Deadpool. It's because there's different types of humor. He doesn't take stuff seriously because he can't talk about his trauma because he's been through some shit. He has like cancer and also can never die. It's complicated for the brain to cope with that. And that's his whole shtick, is that every movie is him trying to break through that emotional barrier. And I feel like when people do that badly is when they don't understand like the emotional side of why they act like that. and to have that little moment of, oh, he has feelings. And I do feel like I'm not like the biggest Deadpool fan, but I think they were pretty good because they had those like those quite sweet moments with his like his girlfriend and then his like found family. Like you gotta have that as well to make it work.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and that's so, the Deadpool works with Deadpool because that's the way exactly. It does it. So if anyone else is doing that, that's because they're not doing it well. Mm-hmm. And actually, why I think Deadpool works in this kind of like, was kind of a, certainly if you think about him in the consent of like, you know, you can't put MCU in with the Fox ones because they're a different studios. It's a different thing. So actually, Deadpool was the kind of doing something different within the universe that Fox did. But then if you put it in with MCU, I guess it kind of like fits, but like MCU doing that, that's got, they're like not, they weren't under the same creative teams. They weren't under the same umbrella at that point. So yeah, I'm a bit like, yeah. I just feel like let Deadpool be there because, and also I like it because it's like Ryan Reynolds, you know, like you said, like he's like massive. He's gone through so much trauma. He's kind of gone, like he's mentally unwell. As a character. And I think the film should have done pushed that a bit more because he talks like he has a voice in his head and like he's, it's kind of batshit and I love it about the character. But I think sometimes because it works, that kind of humor works well for Deadpool, but I think sometimes with Ryan Reynolds doing that in other bits, I find it a bit grating. But for me, Deadpool, it works. Anyway, sorry.
Yeah. So
I had to get that hot take out.
we're keeping Ryan Reynolds as, because he's kind of, he's not X-Men.
No. But yes. No,
okay, so it doesn't matter who plays Deadpool. Yeah, no,
Deadpool is not of all UV cast.
Yeah, yes. So we're bringing, okay, we're in the room with Kevin Feige. we're bringing the X-Men back. He's got his baseball cap on. We're bringing the X-Men back. Who, I guess, first you got to decide which X-Men, because there's a lot of them, which ones should the MCU prioritize, and then who should play them? I have no ideas.
I'm just going to say right off the top, obviously, Cyclops, leader of the X-Men in the field anyway, you obviously bring them back. And you know what? Because of how underutilized he was in the Fox movies, I would like to give James Marsden another shot in this role. He hasn't aged.
No.
He's still a really good actor. I feel like with a really good script, he could do justice to Cyclops. And especially in the early episodes of X-Men 97, Cyclops was trending because people were like, this is awesome. Why haven't we ever seen Cyclops do this on screen? Because that's what Cyclops is capable of. Cyclops is a dude who the other X-Men follow in the field. He's a leader. Not a leader to the extent of a Captain America, who I still think is that dude. But he is the leader of the X-Men. And we never really get to see that in the Fox movies because they found something with Hugh Jackman's Wolverine. They're like, we're going to shape everything around Wolverine in all the movies. And to a degree, you know, it worked. You know, Hugh Jackman is that dude. I understand why they did it. But they did it to the detriment of Cyclops in a major, major, major way. So I feel like when they bring these guys back to the MCU, bring James Marsden back as Cyclops, I think... could be good.
Counterpoint.
Okay.
Oh, what's his name? Who played Elvis and Priscilla?
Jacob Elordi.
Jacob Elordi, I think, would be a great Cyclops.
Okay.
Because I'm scooching my chair up. I'm interested.
tell me more. Because I think, again, hopefully, if they go into this kind of like lean into the sincerity of it, and I really hope they do, because I think watching X-Men 97 has really kind of reconfirmed that latest episode was fucking insane.
Yeah, it was.
And I'm going to get into who I want to play Rogue immediately after this. But I think he is serious and he's tall and he's got the hair and he's got that kind of like, I don't know, he's quite, I think he does play that quite. And even watching him in Euphoria and stuff, I think Cyclops, I think Scott Summers, like he quite holds a lot of stuff in. Mm-hmm. He's always trying to be a bit stoic. But there's like a deep kind of like vulnerability underneath that because mm-hmm. he literally can't look anyone in the eye. So there's this sense of he's so tightly wound because he could literally kill someone if he opens his eyes without his glasses on. Mm-hmm. Like that level of like, oh my God, I am a weapon of mass destruction. Mm-hmm. And I think Jacob Elordi could do that very well. And I could believe him being like, oh, so he's like super mad hot and like, Cyclops' hot spark as well. So
excuse me, Hannah, thirsting is not allowed. Only I can thirst on this pod. Thank you very much.
Actually, I think you forget that women's rights and women thirsting is less aggressive than men thirsting. Mm-hmm. I don't know what it is. I don't make the rules. I'm sorry. That's just the nature. Like, this is the matriarchy fighting back against the patriarchy. We are a matriarchal podcast. I'm so sorry, Amon. Two against one.
Oh, my gosh.
So I think he'd be good. I think we've never had a good rogue. I'm really sorry, Anna Paquin, but that rogue character was shit.
Yeah.
Not her fault. We need to have... It's not her fault, yeah. But like they just... What I'd really like is if they just had the casting done well, but I imagine how they... Because obviously Rogue gets her main powers of flight and like powers from
Captain Marvel.
Mm-hmm. So that would be an interesting thing to happen. But I would love, and I didn't even come up with this fan casting, but someone did. And Kiki Palmer would be an excellent Rogue. Because her personality suits Rogue. Can you imagine, like, Kiki Palmer, hey, sugar. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, she's vivacious. She's sexy. She's cute. She's got like a really just like a charming personality. And she's also super vulnerable at times. Like, I don't know. I think rewatching like watching the X-Men 97 and that sort of casting, I think she'd be far more suited to playing like Rogue than she would be playing like Storm, who is quite a regal, not saying that Kiki Palmer can't do regal, but I just love the natural personality traits that Kiki has that exudes, like she comes out, she would really exude that in Rogue.
I like that. I like that a lot. I'm not sure if she's not young enough for this now, but
how are we doing it? Where are we setting it? What do you think it is? Is it going to be?
I mean, there's so many questions that I don't know exactly which way they're going to go yet. But when I think of the spirit of Jubilee, I think of Kelly Marie Tran. And I feel like she would embody that character very, very well. The brightness of her, the enthusiasm, the optimism, all that sort of stuff. I've seen Kelly Marie Tran do that very, very well. And I feel like she'd be great casting for that character.
She would. Where the fuck has she been?
Yeah, it's a good question.
But this is what I'm talking about like how she was in that TV series Sorry for Your Loss, which I'm literally Googling now, upcoming projects. She's in The Young Wife alongside Kiersey Clemons. Oh, she's developing a biopic about civil rights activist and a close friend, Amanda Nugent. Okay. Oh, she did Raya and the Last Dragon.
She did that
Dragon
as well, yeah.
But you're not really hearing about her, and it's like classic of, you know, it's like the Mina Massoud thing as well, like, be like this thing.
Yeah,
I think Stephanie Hsu would be a good...
Oh, that's a good shout to
be a good Jubilee. Is there any character that you kind of love, Clarice, an X-Men, like any X-Men character? Well, who would Wolverine be, apart from, because are they going to keep him? Would you recast it? I guess we're not recasting it now, it's just Hugh Jackman until he dies. Although he's probably the right age now. It's probably like the right age to play Wolverine. Because Wolverine's always the older guy. And he's like 100, he's like a, you know, immortal pretty much, isn't he?
Well, I'm a big Magneto person, but I don't really have any suggestions for that. I do have one. Dazzler.
I
feel like they should get Sabrina Carpenter.
Oh,
that's my contribution. Okay. I'm tapping out now.
Oh, why?
God, that's so ugly. Interesting.
What's she been in that you've seen her in? Or just like as a musician?
She's Coachella? An actress, right? Yeah, I imagine Dazzler doesn't have to. She just sings, right? When she does the little, like, when she goes on tour and she does the personalized ending of the song where she's, like, rhyming the city.
See, you say all of this, there is a rumor going around that one Taylor Swift has been cast in Deadpool and Wolverine. And if that is true, then the character that I imagine that she's playing is Dazzler. The look that Hannah just gave us was one of intense excitement, people.
Looking forward to Taylor Swift proving once again that she cannot act. I say this, Rihanna cannot act.
Sabrina's got more of the, she's got like a kind of flirtatious energy to her, which I feel like would be very good for Dazzler.
Yeah.
Sorry, Taylor.
You mentioned Magneto. I've said this for a while, but Denzel as Magneto really excites me. And I can absolutely see it. Oh, I think
I don't know. I think, you know, I think it's one time I do think you should get a Jewish actor to play a Jewish person. So, Yeah, I don't know about that. I don't know who...
Do you feel the same way about Professor X, given the storm that we kicked off and Giancarlo Esposito and that interview?
I feel very strongly about that. I do, because there's just so, like, dog shit representation in superhero movies for disabled people and giving disabled actors opportunities. And I really think, like, if we're going to have those standards in other places, why don't disabled people get the same, like... And but he's, like, such a huge character, and it's such a big deal. It'd be such a big deal to have a wheelchair user play that role. Like, I feel like that's the one to just, like, please just find somebody, you know?
I mean, that's the thing, isn't it? What's so interesting is that you could have, like... I always think if you've got enough star power elsewhere, then you could put someone in, like someone else. I can understand the difficulty. It depends on the storyline, isn't it? So sometimes, because obviously, you know, even there are times where I thought it was interesting how they did it with X-Men First Class and Days of Future Past. And it's this idea. Yeah. And even actually, that's the kind of thing that they kind of stole from. No, they didn't steal, but like Doctor Strange kind of stole from that kind of character of, like, he could walk if he focuses his mind on it, on, like, focusing on his walking. And it's like, and the same thing in, you know, in Doctor Strange, there's, like, the character that Benjamin Bratt plays. He's like, oh, I'm just using these powers to just, like, using this, like, energy so I can walk and play around because I was in a car, you know, accident, and I didn't want to be disabled anymore. So, and it's, like, kind of, like, accept, like, and I kind of love that just Strange is, like, accepting your disability and using it in another way to do great, great good. So I think that's what I like about Professor X. It's, like, he could use that power for selfish, for, like, doing this thing, but he recognises that it doesn't stop him from being the most powerful person in the world.
And I think that could be a great storyline if you've got, like, an actor who's a wheelchair user and then had a storyline about him knowing that he had the option. Because that's, like, a big, like, emotional thing that disabled people have is, like, that, oh, what would my life be like if I didn't have this disability? And going, actually, no, fuck that. I like the person that I am. Like, that would be such a, like, cool storyline to have for Professor X. So that's my one thing. That and Sabrina Carpenter. I don't care what else they do with the X-Men.
I think if they're going to make Emma Frost an X-Man, as she has been in the past, then Margot Robbie would be a very good shout for that.
Yeah. And one thing that did really annoy me about the X-Men Days of Future Past, that, like, I guess it's Matthew Vaughn's. Is it Matthew Vaughn's?
No, that was Bryan Singer.
Bryan Singer. I will say, it was Matthew Vaughn who did First Class.
Correct.
So, and he did ruin Emma Frost, that character. Sorry. The problem with Emma Frost is, like, one of the most interesting characters in it. And, like, they basically stole her narrative and gave it to Jennifer Lawrence for Mystique, rather than it being, like, because Emma Frost is, like, part of the villain thing, you know, obviously with Sebastian Shaw, but she ends up becoming... same with Magneto. It's this kind of, she has this whole thing about kind of transitioning and embracing the kind of more the kind of X-Men kind of being good rather than being like everything's shooting the world to shit. So I'd love to see Emma Frost back if they did it well. Yeah, I don't know. Margot would be great, but I'm just, it's a difficult one, isn't it? I reckon Rebecca, I know she might do, but I think Rebecca Hall would be a good Emma Frost.
Ooh, I could see that. She's a fantastic actress, my goodness. For Jean Grey, who do you think?
But I don't want a Margot Robbie, because I think Margot Robbie is Harley Quinn, and I don't think she should be touching any of her superheroes. I think she should. I think this thing where people play loads of them, I'm always like, just have your one. Maybe that's why Hugh Jackson's like, I'll do this one forever. But, like, don't be greedy. Margot Robbie doesn't need to play Emma Frost and Harley Quinn.
And Barbie.
And Barbie, good.
The real superhero.
As Margot Robbie's agent, I disagree. No. But I could see her in the role. For Jean Grey, Evan Rachel Wood? I guess, like, some of it would be dependent on who you cast as Cyclops. Need that chemistry.
She might be a good Emma Frost.
Evan Rachel Wood, okay.
She could be, maybe. I think she might be good Jean, because she was really good in Westworld.
Yeah.
And she, and that's it. And, but then I wonder if like that character is too close to the Jean Grey, because obviously Jean Grey goes like to Phoenix and it's kind of this like, you know, this all powerful thing. And I wonder if it's a bit too, you know, because I kind of don't want people to do the same things that they've done before, but I guess like just that character feels very Jean Grey.
Who would you cast as Gambit?
Which one's Gambit's the card one, right? Wasn't it going to be Channing Tatum?
It was going to be Channing Tatum. And then that movie was kicked down the can and kicked down the can and kicked down the can. Is now, I don't think, no longer happening. What about Ethan Hawke for Cyclops? For Gambit? Good grief.
No, Ethan Hawke's too old. I would actually like them to cast a French actor for Gambit. Because obviously it's like New Orleans. Like that's kind of like that sort of... It's like that Louisiana, he's got a bit of a French, I don't know. I feel like it'd be quite fun to have someone a bit like that. Who would I think, what French actor do I quite like? Who's the one who's,
oh my God.
Matthias Schoen, no, go on.
Swan Arnaud.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, what, from a time out to be a, from Anatomy of Fall.
They're hot lawyering. I don't know anything about this character. I don't know if that's a good casting.
I guess it's like, who would have good, like, just say we got my casting perfectly of Rogue and it was Kiki Palmer. Who do you think would be a good, like...
I like her a lot.
Yeah.
Oh, this is who I think. Louis Garrel. He would be, I think he'd be a good Gambit.
He would. He would.
And I know... And I know technically he's only kind of done it like a couple of times, but like, and I know he plays like Helmet Zemo. But I feel like Daniel Brühl would be quite a good Nightcrawler.
Interesting. Interesting. I like that a lot, you know.
I like that one. I was thinking as well, like Matthias Schoenaert, I really like as an actor. And I'm like, I'm like, let's name an actor and who would they play? Actors Hannah likes that we can cast in an X-Men film. But is there any actor that you'd love to see more of? I guess that's the thing though, isn't it? Because like, I don't know if I'd want to force a superhero movie on certain actors. But, because you know what I mean? Because it's quite an intense thing. So if you could do like what in and out. But I guess there's also, like, what character... I would really like to see a Monet Sankoir, and if they did the Generation X storyline, you know, and they tried to do, you know, I think that would be really cool, because that's Emma Frost. You've got Banshee in that one. Yeah. And Monet Sankoir is, like, probably, like, the only, only like, Marvel Comics character who I can find that's actually, like, North African. Like, she's from Abelfi, and then there's a whole storyline with her. So I like having someone like Lynn Khoury, or having Suhelia Yacoub. That might be cool to get that storyline in, because she's like the character's like French Algerian, I think, and Lynn Khoury is French Algerian, and that might be a cool way to like get some representation at the school. And then you've got these like, who else is the other characters in that? But it would I think that's the thing as well. It's like, what about introducing more new characters from the X-Men rather than just the old hands? And then you don't have to like worry about who's done it best and who's playing, you know?
I think that's going to be a major key in what the MCU do with this new incarnation of the X-Men whenever we get it. As I mentioned earlier, a lot of the Fox movies, if not all of the Fox movies, were very geared around Wolverine. And I get why they did that, and in many respects it works, but that was to the detriment of the team as a whole. And I feel like this new version of the X-Men is not going to make that same mistake. I mean, X-Men 97 has proven that beautifully. Yes, Wolverine is there. Yes, he has his moments, but it's a team show. And the film, the show is giving a lot of attention to various people. And honestly, Wolverine is very low down the list in terms of who's getting the most stuff. And that's worse because everyone now is so familiar with Wolverine. We know what he's about. There's so much other interesting stuff to get into with everybody else. And I feel like both X-Men 97 and this new live-action X-Men is going to get into that in a very cool way. And I feel like also in Deadpool and Wolverine, it's going to set the stage for mutants as a whole in the MCU in a big way. I'm really excited to see it. I'm almost as excited as Hannah, but I don't know if anyone's that excited.
It's true. I'll watch it. Maybe I'll like it.
I'm actually excited to see it. Yeah, quite like that. Deadpool's like my dad's favorite. Oh, weird, he loves Deadpool, and I don't know why. Just because it's not very in his character to enjoy Deadpool. But thanks for tuning in and happy viewing via whatever medium is safest for you. Please subscribe, rate, and review the podcast. It makes a difference. And tweet us any questions or hot takes at ThetaBlackPod on Twitter. I'm at Clarice Liu on Twitter or at Clarice Lockery on Instagram.
I'm at Amon Woman on Twitter and Instagram.
I'm at Hannah Nesplint on Instagram. Letterboxd. I should update that today.
Farewell, film friends. It's time to fade to black.